Today at Reader's Corner, novelist Sean Vestal, author of Daredevils. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. As every reader knows, novels can transport us to unexpected places. They also can shine new light on places we thought were already familiar. Today's guest, Sean Vestal, manages to do both in his debut novel, Daredevils. Daredevils is a coming-of-age story about taking big risks. It features colorful characters, a southern Idaho setting, an epic road trip, and a fast-paced narrative that offers surprises till the very end. While fiction, it alludes to several historic events, including Evel Knievel's famous attempt to rocket across the Snake River Canyon near Twin Falls, Idaho in 1974, and the federal raids on a polygamist colony in northern Arizona in 1953. Sean Vestal is a longtime journalist who writes a column for the Spokesman Review in Spokane, Washington. He won the 2014 Penn Robert W. Bingham Prize for his short story collection, Godforsaken Idaho, and his work has been published in a number of literary magazines. Mr. Vestal will be in Boise later this month as a presenter at Storyfort, the literary and story-centric festival that is part of the annual music fest, Treefort. Storyfort is free and open to the public, and you can find out more online at treefortmusicfest.com. Mr. Vestal joins us today by phone from Spokane for this interview. Sean Vestal, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Hey, that's a pretty big deal, that 2014 Penn Robert W. Bingham Prize. How'd you feel about that? I mean, that's really notable. They don't give many of those out.
Yeah, it was just a very sort of wonderful, unexpected surprise. You know, I wasn't really expecting it to win prizes or be nominated for prizes. And so it was just, the whole thing was just really sort of dizzying and exciting. And I went back to New York for the ceremony thinking, this is really what I won here, was a chance to get to New York and rub elbows with some writers who I admire. And I was just stunned that I won. So the whole thing was just a little bit surreal and quite exciting.
I have a copy of Godforsaken Idaho that I've had on my desk for a long time, and I never really got into it. And then when your novel came, I thought, well, do the novel first. I'll go back and get the book of short stories. One of the things that I must say struck me was it isn't exactly a title that the Chamber of Commerce of Idaho would be in favor of, I suppose, huh?
Right. I always, you know, and it's one of those things where it's an aesthetic part of me that I always say, especially when I'm in Idaho or around people that I know from Idaho, that it's not my judgment on the state of Idaho. And yet, that being said, I made that the title of the book knowing that it might have that resonance or that's the possible one
right.
way to look at it. But I just, to me, there's something about those words, and I say it almost like I wasn't responsible, though of course I was responsible. But in writing a character and who used that phrase to describe Idaho, a person from Chicago who had come to Idaho sort of fleeing his life in a way and felt a sort of deep sort of loneliness, deep kind of estrangement from the world. It just seemed, I just really liked the phrase and it felt like that was the title the moment those words sort of entered the page. So I love Idaho, but I guess I was willing to tweak a little bit,
sure,
given that
sure.
it's my home.
Why not?
And I feel some ownership. Yeah.
So having lived in Illinois once upon a time, I was struck by Libertyville and Lake Forest. I think he came from Libertyville. And
yeah.
do you just dream that up? Or you go to a map and throw a dart on the map, or did you hang out in Libertyville yourself?
I have never been there. What I had was a college friend.
I see.
And the rest of his life is nothing at all like that guy's life. But he did have this sort of decline in family fortune that went from Lake Forest to Libertyville in his mind. And so that's just a little thing I stole from his life.
I see. Well, anyway, I want to remind our readers, the name of the short stories is Godforsaken Idaho. Sean Vestal's the author. It's really interesting. And even more interesting from my vantage point, since I just finished the book, is Daredevils. And I want to talk about that. First of all, I don't know how many writers I've heard, Sean, talk about the importance of starting close to home where you're comfortable, write about what you know about. Boy, it looks like you sure did that. Tell us a little bit about your Idaho roots.
Well, I grew up in Gooding, small town about 30 miles from Twin Falls, and
one of
small
the sites
farming
in the
town.
Book. One of the sites in the book. Yeah.
Right. And so, to my way of thinking, the book is kind of half and half in terms of its relationship to my life. So, one strand of the story that's set in Gooding, and it's told about a young man who's a teenager, and his childhood was, in some ways, very similar to my own childhood, especially in terms of place and time. Then there's this other piece that involves fundamentalist Mormons and polygamists and polygamy and the polygamous community down in the northern Arizona, southern Utah border. And that to me is not, although I'm aware of that world and it connects in some way to the Mormon world that I came from, it's very distant. I didn't know anything about it. And so that was pretty far from my own personal experience. And so I was sort of going back and forth in the writing that in that novel. But my own background is I lived in Gooding my whole life. I grew up there. I went to the University of Idaho for several years, though I didn't finish. And I've lived all around the state, from southern Idaho to Coeur d'Alene and Moscow. And so,
well, in the time we have available here, I hope to cover Evel Knievel's jump across the Snake River, the raid on the fundamentalist Mormon community in Short Creek, Arizona, and the Great Jackrabbit Massacre in 1981. That, I must say, I didn't know a thing about, and I can't wait to get there. But before we get there, I'd like to start with just something. Again, we're not going to give away this book because I want people to have as much fun reading it as I did, and so we're certainly not going to go there. But I think you could at least tell us about Loretto, because Loretta is really the protagonist. I mean, it's she shares the pages, of course, with Jason and a couple of other guys. But walk through Loretta's life, and again, just to the point where we're not spoiling anything, nothing you can't read on the jacket cover.
Well, Loretta is a 15-year-old, at the start of the novel, she's a 15-year-old girl living in Short Creek, Arizona. Short Creek, Arizona is basically the community that they now call Colorado City, although many people still colloquially call it Short Creek. I kept the old name, and it's a fundamentalist, polygamous community, as I said, on the border of northern Arizona and southern Utah. And part of that was strategic for a while, when the fundamentalists could sort of move back and forth across state lines when they were trying to avoid the authorities and stuff. Loretta's living in that community. She's a rebellious kid, basically. She's a kid who likes to kind of sneak out and get in trouble. And her parents sort of punish and or protect her soul to some degree, I guess, in their view, want to have her married off into a polygamous family to become the second wife in a kind of a young, up-and-coming polygamous man's family. And she does not want to do that. She does not want that life. And I'd say the sort of main tension of the novel is her trying to figure out whether she can get out of that, whether she can get away from that. Early drafts of the novel, she was kind of a secondary character. And I would write it and show it to friends of mine who kind of give me good advice. And they would always say, yeah, this is pretty good, but you know who I'm really interested in is this girl and her dramatic situation. And it took me a long time to sort of evolve toward trying to tell her story because it's very distant from my own life. I mean, for one thing, I've never been a teenage girl. You know, I've never lived in a polygamous community. I don't know anything about that community that didn't come from research. Whereas many of the other things I write, I'm drawing on my own life in a more direct way.
Well, it's interesting you say that Loretta was the secondary character because as I'm reading this novel, I am rooting for Loretta. And the only thing that's frustrating me is, Loretta, what is taking you so long? Why can't you figure this out sooner? And my question was something like, you know, how does this work as you're constructing the novel? You obviously want this novel to be a yarn long enough to keep the reader engaged, so it's not like you want something to happen early in the book that really can't happen until later on. Or does it just flow? Or do you just get into this thing and away you go and it all just naturally comes into place because these characters are beyond your control? And I've heard various versions of this depending on what author I'm interviewing.
Yeah. You know, that is not the way it works with me, I would say. The characters do, sometimes when I'm writing, things go off in unexpected directions. But for me, it's a lot of revising. And in this case, it was bringing Loretta from the background to the forefront. That was a lot of what the work was about. So it wasn't some process where I was unaware of where I was going. Or at least once I had written a couple of drafts, and I wrote several drafts of the novel. Definitely in the first draft, I'm just sort of blind in the woods, you know. But after that, I'm doing things with a little bit more intention. And in this case, how long until she tried to get away was a thing that I asked myself a lot, because she's a mature character in many ways, but I also wanted to reinforce the idea that she was a child, you know. She's 15 and 16 years old, and sure, she's pretty savvy for her age, that it isn't that easy to just run away from something you've always known. My instinct with her is just get away. Like, why not? You know, why wait at all? And there are some moments where she could pretty easily just walk away and does not. And I really tried to think about those moments as hopefully ways to just sort of illustrate that she's still young, and that there's some attachment that we all have to the situation we're in, even if we think we hate it, and it's the only one that we know, you know, we still in some way are, you know, that knowledge, that familiarity is something that's hard to leave.
You're listening to Reader's Corner, and I'm talking today with Sean Vestal about his debut novel, Daredevils. So if Loretta was difficult, more difficult than some of the other characters, because again, you're not a teenage girl, Jason, on the other hand, one of the other characters, absolutely seems to have a life that coincides with your real life. And why don't you refresh our memory on Evel Knievel's famous jump? And at the time, I believe you were sitting in Gooding just wishing you could have gone there like Jason.
That's right. And that is the start of this novel, really, although it goes in lots of different directions. But so I was 8 years old at the time that Knievel came to jump the canyon, and I was a fan of his. That year I had gotten the Evel Knievel wind-up toy that was the best-selling toy in the nation the previous Christmas. I had gotten it for Christmas, and you know, like so many people that grew up, I think especially in the West, but not just in the West, you know, we jumped our bikes off ramps, and we were just big fans of Evel Knievel. He was on TV every weekend, it seemed like. And so when he came to town, I thought, well, sure, we'll go see that. But my parents wouldn't take me. Now, I mean, I have a 9-year-old right now, and so I'm pretty aware of the many good reasons you wouldn't take a child to that event. But all I really took away from it as a kid was that we couldn't do it because it was Sunday, and that in our faith we kept the Sabbath day holy. And I sort of jokingly say that planted the seeds of my departure from Mormonism, not being able to go see Evel Knievel. There might be some truth in that, you know, these little resentments that build up. But it definitely explains, I think, why I might have started with a scene. You know, the first thing I wrote is the second chapter in the book about Jason, the mm-hmm. teenage character, going to see the jump with mm-hmm. his grandfather.
So, as we all know, Evel Knievel didn't quite make that jump. I guess the parachute opened prematurely. But last September, Eddie Braun did. Did you have any temptation to drive down or fly down from Spokane to watch that? Or did you?
I did.
You did.
I didn't. I didn't go watch it. No, I had a temptation to.
I see.
And I wanted to. I wrote a piece about the engineer, the rocket engineer for that Eddie Braun jump, whose name is Scott Truax, and he's a guy who lives in Twin Falls. And his father was the rocket engineer for Knievel, and he has been wanting to do this to sort of redeem his father's name, as he sees it. And I wrote a piece about him for the New Yorker's website a couple years ago. So that was when he was still preparing, and it was never quite clear whether it would actually happen. It wasn't to me, anyway. I was a little dubious, maybe, that it would happen. And then when it came to pass, they had a kind of a pay-per-view situation in terms of access and not letting people get close. And so I didn't go down to just – because I would have just been – standing from afar and watching it. But I was interested in it, and interested to see that he made it across the canyon. I think Knievel would have made it if his parachute hadn't popped out.
But one of the things that I read somewhere, and it's interesting you talk about the fact that Scott Truax was the rocket engineer, which suggests that this is going to be a very technical jump on Knievel's part, is that he wasn't much of a technician. He wasn't much of a calculator. And it's not like he did all the numbers to measure distance, speed, height, right? I mean, it was just like Evel Knievel by the seat of his pants?
Knievel was certainly that way.
Yeah.
Bob Truax, Scott Truax's father, he was a legitimate engineer, and he did all of those things. He worked for NASA, and he did all sorts of space program stuff. He was the real deal. Knievel was much more of sort of a rash, throw yourself into the void kind of a daredevil.
So let's talk about the great Jackrabbit Massacre and how you managed to work this into your novel. Again, we don't want to give anything away, but I don't think it really does. You might just start with real life. What happened back there in 1981, and how does that serve your purpose when it comes to the role that Jason seems to play? Because he seems to be the kid that's really having the most difficulty, and also I believe his parents were looking askew while this whole thing was going on. I might be wrong about that. But anyway, let's stick with the description of what was the problem with jackrabbits in eastern Idaho.
Well, it's a periodic issue, for farmers in southern and eastern Idaho. These sort of jackrabbit explosions, and they do cause great harm to the crops, and they're a real problem for farmers. And over the years, historically, this was one of the ways that farming communities would try to deal with outbreaks of jackrabbits, which was have these bunny bashes, as they were somewhat called when I was younger, and I never saw one, and there was never one held where I grew up in my lifetime in Gooding. There was one in Mud Flats, which is a place kind of that I've not been to, but is over in eastern, a little farther east, eastern Idaho. And I think the last one was, as you said, in 81 or 82, and I remember reading about it. And it was just one of those things that really I think a lot of farm life, you're putting your hands on life and death in certain ways. And some of it you're comfortable with and some of it you're not. And that bash is just one of those things that some people were like, whatever, you just got to kill the rabbits. And other people were like, that was brutal and awful. And I think it stuck with me as feeling kind of brutal and awful. Feeling, I remember seeing pictures in the newspaper of a father and a son, each with a bat. And I would have been probably a sophomore in high school then. And I don't know. I just found it kind of distasteful. So, I wanted to have a scene in the novel that offered some kind of a shock, maybe, to these characters, offered something that might kind of jar them out of feeling like they were just in a kind of a regular routine that they couldn't get out of. I wanted to provide them some sort of shock to the system. And that seemed kind of visceral and disturbing and appalling. And so that was why I selected that for that purpose in the narrative. And I was also, I have to say, drawn toward the idea of writing about a big spectacle like that, a big kind of disturbing spectacle that brings a lot of different forces, I guess, together. I guess one of the things that I thought about when I was doing that is I wanted to sort of not be extremely judgmental about that event. I wanted to not be extremely judgmental, say, about the polygamists involved, or at least I wanted to be open to their humanity and the reasons they might have done the things that they did, not to make sort of the easy, obvious judgments, maybe.
I'm Bob Custer, a host of Reader's Corner, and my guest is prize-winning writer Sean Vestal, author of the novel Daredevils. Yeah, I think you did a good job on that. And while we're on this subject, since you mentioned it, let's talk about Short Creek, Arizona, and take us back to 1953. What happened and how that fits into your book?
Well, there was a raid that was primarily carried out by state by sheriff's officials from Arizona in the area, and the governor was involved, and a lot of people think, and I don't know the reality of this, that the mainstream Mormon church was also partly involved, because this is in at a time when the mainstream Mormon church is trying to distance itself from polygamy. You know, it's been sort of formally outlawed within the church for 100 years or so, but it's still obviously persisted, and the mainstream church was wanting to set itself apart. So there was a lot of pressure to do something about the fundamentalists. And this cycle, I mean, this has continued on, you know, it continued on to the present day in terms of how do prosecutors in Utah deal with some of these cases. They go through cycles of sort of tolerance and prosecution, you know, let them be or go after them. And that's just a constant cycle. And so this was reaching kind of a political breaking point. People were, you know, the governor of Arizona was raising a lot of hell about it. And so they sent in these officers, primarily sheriff's officers, but there were some state police and others. And they went into this community, they went into Short Creek and arrested the men, took away the women and children, kept some of the families separate for days and weeks. And I don't know the details of this, but every account I've read says some of the children were never returned. And there's a Life magazine series of photographs that's pretty easy to find online. And I looked at that just all the time when I was writing this. It's one of the last things I wrote in the novel was to go back and add this scene, which is it's way out of the narrative of the main body of the story, which occurs in the 70s. But, you know, as I was writing these polygamists, I found myself writing these kind of stern, unlovable characters, which to some degree I'm all right with, you know, I mean, but I wanted to think about like not making them sort of cardboard cutout evil types. Like, you know, I'd like to think that nobody thinks of themselves. Everybody thinks of themselves as a good person, as a well-motivated person, as having reasons for what they do. And I wanted to, I don't know, I wanted to provide some counterweight to, maybe the less admirable parts of their characters that I was depicting. And I thought about that event as a thing that would live in your life and the generations of your family's life forever. If something like that happened to you, if some organization came in and took your children away from you, I mean, could you possibly radicalize somebody more than by doing that? Could you possibly guarantee those people would, distrust the government, believe themselves to be persecuted by a perhaps evil system than by doing that? And so I wanted to write about that. I guess I wanted to hopefully humanize or provide some level of understanding for why a community might see itself as so radically outside the mainstream, what kind of justified reasons they might have for seeing themselves in that way.
And I think you explored the impact of this on Ruth, who I think lived through this event in your book, and then emerges as the wife of this guy, Dean, who chooses to take a second wife, a 15-year-old, and she's like amoral about the whole thing. She's like in, it seems, some form of shock where she's incapable of dealing with it. I mean, you apparently were trying to convey that very thought that how could you react at that stage of the game, or how would you react given what you have been through yourself? Is that right?
Yes, to some degree. But also, Ruth is someone who just, I think, she's kind of a hard character. And I wanted to show maybe some of what might have gone into that hardening rather than just have her be a little bit of an unsympathetic sourpuss, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I like the way you put it in terms of her, a kind of a shocked relationship with the situation. But I do also think that she's very willful, and that the part of her whole approach is to just force herself to accept things. I don't know, that there's a strength of her will, I think, as well, that I'm hoping to convey anyway.
You have a couple of scenes in here between Loretta and the polygamist husband. I won't go into any details, but they're fairly graphic. How much time do you spend wondering and worrying how to do that and where to draw the line and how graphic you should get and not get in terms of how people are going to receive the book.
Yeah. Well, a lot, I would say. I thought about it a lot. But in the actual writing of it, I probably just did what was feeling right in the moment. I don't know. I did spend a good amount of time thinking about it. And I think my work is full of R-rated stuff. And I come from an LDS family. And I'm very aware of that when I'm doing it. There's a part of me that thinks, well, this kind of puts it out of mom's reach, you know, like mom, she can't really appreciate this. And I mean that sincerely, like it's something that is an obstacle for her and I'm in it. But I also, I don't know, I feel some obligation to try to be true to whatever my impulse is in that kind of work. And so one of the things I worried about in writing A Teenage Girl was I don't understand the sort of sexual situation she's going to be in with this older man, but it seems important to me to convey it because it seems like it would be kind of, I don't know. I mean, it just seems like an awkward, unnatural place for two people to be in. That's not, you know, this 40-year-old man and this 15-year-old girl. That's not, yeah. You know, that's not how it's supposed to be, I guess, in my mind. You know, there's something unnatural about that.
Yeah.
Though, and so I don't know. I guess I felt like it was kind of important to be there to some degree. Now, how explicit, I don't know. You know, sometimes I look at that passage and it's like I certainly, I'm at the edge of my comfort level, I guess, with it. Mm-hmm. But I wanted that moment to have that feel, I guess. Mm-hmm. I wanted it to be uncomfortable. So I don't know whether I made the right decision or not, but I do think a lot about it, and I try not to be gratuitous. Mm-hmm. But I recognize that it's too much for some people, mm-hmm. just the way that, I don't know, the cursing or the drug use and some of the other things that I've written might be too much for some people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it may well be, but I think you made the right decision, and I think you did it well. And when I said earlier that I was rooting for Loretta, I mean, one of the reasons I'm rooting for Loretta is probably because of what I'm reading and what I'm imagining, and you, all of a sudden the pictures start appearing to the reader, and it's like, girl, you've got to get out of this situation, and that builds the suspense for the reader. It builds the novel. So I see certainly where you're going on that. So are you working on something else?
Yeah, I'm always I have some stories I'm working on, and I have a novel that's oh, at this point, I'd have to say it's in the very early stages, but it's a novel about, I have an ancestor who was the first Jewish man to be baptized into the Mormon church, or at least that's, they believe that he was, mm-hmm. Alexander Nybar, and he's a fascinating historical character, and so I have started working on something that's kind of a fictionalized version of his life, but it's very early on, early enough that it might be wiser not even to mention it, but I'm trying to, yeah.
Well, we're going to have a chance to continue asking you questions, Sean, because, of course, you'll be here a bit later on, and I'm going to give readers and listeners the opportunity to get the details down in a second. But I want to thank you for Daredevils. It's really a great read. I really so much enjoyed learning a few things, but also following the lives of people and learning a little bit about humanity as you've laid it out. Thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate it.
And again, the name of the book is Daredevils by Sean Vestal. And a reminder to our listeners that Sean will be visiting Boise as part of the literary festival Storyfort, which this year runs March 23rd through the 26th. You can find out more online by going to treefortmusicfest.com and clicking on the link for Storyfort. Next week, Leonard Sachs, author of The Collapse of Parenting, How We Hurt Our Kids When We Treat Them Like Grown-Ups. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.